That was half the plot. The second half was, Goodbye, Perry. Dick was sick of him. His harmonica, his aches and ills, his superstitions, the weepy, womanly eyes, the nagging, whispering voice. Suspicious, self-righteous, spiteful, he was like a wife that must be got rid of. And there was but one way to do it. Say nothing. Just go. Absorbed in his plans, Dick did not notice a patrol car pass him. Slow down, reconnoiter. Nor did Perry, descending the post office steps with the Mexican box balanced on a shoulder, observe the prowling car and the policeman in it. Officers O.C. Pigford and Francis McCauley carried in their heads pages of memorized data, including a description of a black and white 1956 Chevrolet bearing Kansas license plate number J016212. Neither Perry nor Dick was aware of the police vehicle trailing them as they pulled away from the post office, and with Dick driving and Perry directing, they traveled 5 blocks north, turned left, then right, drove a quarter mile more, and stopped in front of a dying palm tree and a weather-wrecked sign from which all calligraphy had faded, except the word OOM. "This it?" Dick asked. Perry, as the patrol car drew alongside, nodded. The detective division of the Las Vegas City Jail contains 2 interrogation rooms. Fluorescent lighted chambers measuring 10 by 12, with walls and ceilings of Celotex. In each room, in addition to an electric fan, a metal table, and folding metal chairs, there are camouflaged microphones, concealed tape recorders, and, set into the door, a mirrored one-way observation window. On Saturday, the second day of 1960, both rooms were booked for 2 p.m. the hour that 4 detectives from Kansas had selected for their first confrontation of Hickok and Smith. Shortly before the appointed moment, the quartet of KBI agents, Harold Nye, Roy Church, Alvin Dewey, and Clarence Dunce, gathered in a corridor outside the interrogation rooms. Nye was running a temperature. Part flu, but mostly sheer excitement, he subsequently informed a journalist. By then, I'd already been waiting in Las Vegas 2 days. Took the next plane out after news of the arrest reached our headquarters in Topeka. The rest of the team, Al and Roy and Clarence, came on by car. Had a lousy trip, too. Lousy weather. Spent New Year's Eve snowed up in a motel in Albuquerque. Boy, when they finally hit Vegas, they needed good whiskey and good news. I was ready with both. Our young men had signed waivers of extradition. Better yet, we had the boots, both pairs, and the soles, the cat's paw and the diamond pattern, matched perfectly life-size photographs of the footprints found in the clutter house. The boots were in a box of stuff the boys picked up at the post office just before the curtain fell. Like I told Al Dewey, suppose the squeeze had come 5 minutes sooner. Even so, our case was very shaky. Nothing that couldn't be pulled apart. But I remember, while we were waiting in the corridor, I remember being feverish and nervous as hell, but confident. We all were. We felt we were on the edge of the truth. My job, mine and Church's, was to pressure it out of Hickok. Smith belonged to Al and old man Dunce. At that time, I hadn't seen the suspects. Just examined their possessions and arranged the extradition waivers. I'd never laid eyes on Hickok until he was brought down to the interrogation room. I'd imagined a bigger guy. Brawnier. Not some skinny kid. He was 28, but he looked like a kid. Hungry. Right down to the bone. He was wearing a blue shirt and suntans and white socks and black shoes. We shook hands. His hand was drier than mine. Clean, polite, nice voice, good diction. A pretty decent-looking fella, with a very disarming smile. And in the beginning, he smiled quite a lot. I said, "Mr. Hickok, my name is Harold Nye, and this other gentleman is Mr. Roy Church. We're special agents of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, and we've come here to discuss your parole violation. Of course, you're under no obligation to answer our questions, and anything you say may be used against you in evidence. You're entitled to a lawyer at all times. We'll use no force, no threats, and we'll make you no promises." He was calm as could be. "I know the form," Dick said. "I've been questioned before. Now, Mr. Hickok..." "Dick." "Dick, we want to talk to you about your activities since your parole. To our knowledge, you've gone on at least 2 big check sprees in the Kansas City area."
"Uh-huh.
Hung out quite a few." "Could you give us a list?" The prisoner, evidently proud of his one authentic gift, a brilliant memory, recited the names and addresses of 20 Kansas City stores, cafes, and garages, and recalled accurately the purchase made at each and the amount of the check passed. "I'm curious, Dick. Why do these people accept your checks? I'd like to know the secret."
"The secret is, people are dumb."
Roy Church said, "Fine, Dick. Very funny. But just for the moment, let's forget these checks." Though he sounds as if his throat were lined with hog bristle and has hands so hardened that he can punch stone walls, his favorite stunt, in fact, persons have been known to mistake Church for a kindly little man, somebody's bald-headed, pink-cheeked uncle. "Dick," he said, "suppose you tell us something about your family background." The prisoner reminisced. Once, when he was 9 or 10, his father had fallen ill. It was rabbit fever, and the illness lasted many months, during which the family had depended upon church assistance and the charity of neighbors. Otherwise, we would have starved. That episode aside, his childhood had been okay. "We never had much money, but we were never really down and out," Hickok said. "We always had clean clothes and something to eat. My dad was strict, though. He wasn't happy unless he had me doing chores. But we got along okay. No serious arguments. My parents never argued either. I can't recall a single quarrel. She's wonderful, my mother. Dad's a good guy, too. I'd say they did the best for me they could." "School?" "Well, he felt he might have been more than an average student if he had contributed to books a fraction of the time he'd wasted on sports. Baseball, football, I made all the teams. After high school, I could have gone to college on a football scholarship. I wanted to study engineering, but even with a scholarship, deals like that cost plenty. I don't know. It seemed safer to get a job." Before his 21st birthday, Hickok had worked as a railway trackman, an ambulance driver, a car painter, and a garage mechanic. He'd also married a girl 16 years old. Carol. Her father was a minister. He was dead against me. Said I was a full-time nobody. He made all the trouble he could. But I was nuts about Carol. Still am. There's a real princess. Only, see, we had 3 kids. Boys. And we were too young to have 3 kids. Maybe if we hadn't got so deep into debt. If I could have earned extra money. I tried. He tried gambling and started forging checks and experimenting with other forms of theft. In 1958, he was convicted of house burglary in a Johnson County court and sentenced to 5 years in Kansas State Penitentiary. But by then, Carol had departed and he'd taken as a bride another girl aged 16. Mean as hell. Her and her whole family. She divorced me while I was inside. I'm not complaining. Last August, when I left the walls, I figured I had every chance to start new. I got a job in Olathe, lived with my family, and stayed home nights. I was doing swell. Until November 20th, said Nye, and Hickok seemed not to understand him. The day you stopped doing swell and started hanging paper. Why? Hickok sighed and said, that would make a book. Then, smoking a cigarette borrowed from Nye and lighted by the courteous church, he said, Perry, my buddy Perry Smith was paroled in the spring. Later on, when I came out, he sent me a letter, postmarked Idaho. He wrote reminding me of this deal we used to talk over, about Mexico. The idea was we would go to Acapulco, one of them places, buy a fishing boat and run it ourselves. Take tourists deep-sea fishing. Nye said, this boat, how did you plan to pay for it? I'm coming to that, Hickok said. See, Perry wrote me he had a sister living in Fort Scott, and she was holding some heavy change for him, several thousand dollars, money his dad owed him from the sale of some property up in Alaska. He said he was coming to Kansas to get the dough. And the two of you would use it to buy a boat. Correct. But it didn't work out that way. What happened was, Perry showed up maybe a month later. I met him at the bus station in Kansas City. When? Said Church. The day of the week. A Thursday. And when did you go to Fort Scott? Saturday. November 14th. Hickok's eyes flashed with surprise. One could see that he was asking himself why Church should be so certain of the date. And hurriedly, for it was too soon to stir suspicions, the detective said, what time did you leave for Fort Scott? That afternoon. We did some work on my car and had a bowl of chili at the Westside Cafe. It must have been around 3. Around 3. Was Perry Smith's sister expecting you? No. Because, see, Perry lost her address, and she didn't have a telephone. Then how did you expect to find her? By inquiring at the post office. Did you? Perry did. They said she'd moved away. To Oregon, they thought. But she hadn't left any forwarding address. Must have been quite a blow. After you'd been counting on a big piece of money like that. Hickok agreed. Because, well, we definitely decided to go to Mexico. Otherwise, I never would have cashed them checks. But I hoped. Now listen to me. I'm telling the truth. I thought once we got to Mexico and began making money, then I'd be able to pay them off. The checks. Nye took over. 1 minute, Dick. Nye is a short, short-tempered man who has difficulty moderating his aggressive vigor, his talent for language both sharp and outspoken. I'd like to hear a little more about the trip to Fort Scott, he said, soft-pedaling. When you found Smith's sister no longer there, what did you do then?
Walked around, had a beer, drove back.
You mean you went home? No, to Kansas City. We stopped at the Zesto drive-in, ate hamburgers. We tried Cherry Row. Neither Nye nor Church was familiar with Cherry Row. Hickok said, you kidding? Every cop in Kansas knows it. When the detectives again pleaded ignorance, he explained that it was a stretch of park where one encountered hustlers mostly, adding, but plenty of amateurs too. Nurses, secretaries. I've had a lot of luck there. And this particular evening. Have any luck? The bad kind. We ended up with a pair of rollers. Named? Mildred. The other one, Perry's girl, I think she was called Joan. Describe them. Maybe they were sisters. Both blonde, plump. I'm not too clear about it. See, we'd bought a bottle of ready-mix orange blossoms. That's orange pop and vodka, and I was getting stiff. We gave the girls a few drinks and drove them out to Fun Haven. I imagine you gentlemen never heard of Fun Haven. They hadn't. Hickok grinned and shrugged. It's on the Blue Ridge Road, 8 miles south of Kansas City. A combination nightclub motel. You pay $10 for the key to a cabin. Continuing, he described the cabin in which he claimed that the foursome had stayed the night. Twin beds, an old Coca-Cola calendar, a radio that wouldn't play unless the customer deposited a quarter. His poise, his explicitness, the assured presentation of verifiable detail impressed Nye. Though, of course, the boy was lying. Well, wasn't he? Whether because of flu and fever or an abrupt lessening in the warmth of his confidence, Nye exuded an icy sweat. "Next morning we woke up to find they'd rolled us and beat it," said Hickok. "Didn't get much off me. But Perry lost his wallet with $40 or $50. "What did you do about it?" "There wasn't nothing to do." "You could have notified the police." "Oh, come on. Quit it. Notify the police. For your information, a guy on parole's not allowed to booze or associate with another old grad." "All right, Dick. It's Sunday, the 15th of November. Tell us what you did that day from the moment you checked out of Fun Haven." "Well, we ate breakfast at a truck stop near Happy Hill. Then we drove to Olathe, and I dropped Perry off at the hotel where he was living. I'd say that was around 11. Afterward, I went home and had dinner with the family. Same as every Sunday. Watched TV. A basketball game, or maybe it was football. I was pretty tired." "When did you next see Perry Smith?" "Monday. He came by where I worked. Bob Sands' body shop." "And what did you talk about?" "Mexico." "Well, we still liked the idea, even if we hadn't got hold of the money to do all we had in mind. Put ourselves in business down there. But we wanted to go, and it seemed worth the risk." "Worth another stretch in Lansing?" "That didn't figure. See, we never intended coming stateside again." Nye, who had been jotting notes in a notebook, said, "On the day following the check spree, that would be the 21st, you and your friend Smith disappeared. Now, Dick, please outline your movements between then and the time of your arrest here in Las Vegas. Just a rough idea." Hickok whistled and rolled his eyes. "Wow," he said, and then, summoning his talent for something very like total recall, he began an account of the long ride, the approximately 10,000 miles he and Smith had covered in the past 6 weeks. He talked for an hour and 25 minutes, from 2:50 to 4:15, and told, while Nye attempted to list them, of highways and hotels, motels, rivers, towns, and cities, a chorus of entwining names: Apache, El Paso, Corpus Christi, Saltillo, San Luis Potosí, Acapulco, San Diego, Dallas, Omaha, Sweetwater, Stillwater, Tenville Junction, Tallahassee, Needles, Miami, Hotel Nuevo Waldorf, Somerset Hotel, Hotel Simone, Arrowhead Motel, Cherokee Motel, and many, many more. He gave them the name of the man in Mexico to whom he'd sold his own old 1949 Chevrolet, and confessed that he had stolen a newer model in Iowa. He described persons he and his partner had met: a Mexican widow, rich and sexy; Otto, a German millionaire; a swish pair of Negro prize fighters driving a swish lavender Cadillac; the blind proprietor of a Florida rattlesnake farm; a dying old man and his grandson, and others. And when he had finished, he sat with folded arms and a pleased smile, as though waiting to be commended for the humor, the clarity, and the candor of his traveler's tale. But Nye, in pursuit of the narrative, raced his pen, and Church, lazily slamming a shut hand against an open palm, said nothing, until suddenly he said, "I guess you know why we're here." Hickok's mouth straightened, his posture too. "I guess you realize we wouldn't have come all the way to Nevada just to chat with a couple of two-bit check chiselers. Nye had closed the notebook. He, too, stared at the prisoner and observed that a cluster of veins had appeared in his left temple.
Would we, Dick?
What?
Come this far to talk about a bunch of checks.
I can't think of any other reason. Nye drew a dagger on the cover of his notebook. While doing so, he said, Tell me, Dick, have you ever heard of the Clutter murder case? Whereupon, he later wrote in a formal report of the interview, Suspect underwent an intense, visible reaction. He turned gray. His eyes twitched. Hickok said, Whoa now. Hold on here. I'm no goddamn killer.
The question asked, Church reminded him, was whether you'd heard of the Clutter murders.
I may have read something, Hickok said.
A vicious crime. Vicious. Cowardly.
And almost perfect, Nye said. But you made two mistakes, Dick. One was you left a witness. A living witness. Who will testify in court. Who will stand in the witness box and tell a jury how Richard Hickok and Perry Smith bound and gagged and slaughtered four helpless people.
Hickok's face reddened with returning color. Living witness. There can't be.
Because you thought you'd got rid of everyone.
I said, whoa. There ain't anybody can connect me with any goddamn murder. Checks. A little petty thievery. But I'm no goddamn killer.
Then why, Nye asked hotly, have you been lying to us?
I've been telling you the goddamn truth.
Now and then. Not always. For instance, what about Saturday afternoon, November 14th? You say you drove to Fort Scott.
Yes.
And when you got there, you went to the post office.
Yes.
To obtain the address of Perry Smith's sister.
That's right.
Nye rose. He walked around to the rear of Hickok's chair, and placing his hands on the back of the chair, leaned down as though to whisper in the prisoner's ear. Perry Smith has no sister living in Fort Scott, he said. He never has had. And on Saturday afternoons, the Fort Scott post office happens to be closed.
Then he said, Think it over, Dick. That's all for now. We'll talk to you later.
After Hickok's dismissal, Nye and Church crossed the corridor, and looking through the one-way observation window set in the door of the interrogation room, watched the questioning of Perry Smith, a scene visible, though not audible. Nye, who was seeing Smith for the first time, was fascinated by his feet, by the fact that his legs were so short that his feet, as small as a child's, couldn't quite make the floor. Smith's head, the stiff Indian hair, the Irish-Indian blending of dark skin and pert, impish features reminded him of the suspect's pretty sister, the nice Mrs. Johnson. But this chunky, misshapen child man was not pretty. The pink end of his tongue darted forth, flickering like the tongue of a lizard. He was smoking a cigarette, and from the evenness of his exhalations, Nye deduced that he was still a virgin. That is, still uninformed about the real purpose of the interview. Nye was right. For Dewey and Dunce, patient professionals, had gradually narrowed the prisoner's life story to the events of the last 7 weeks, then reduced those to a concentrated recapitulation of the crucial weekend, Saturday noon to Sunday noon, November 14th to 15th. Now, having spent 3 hours preparing the way, they were not far from coming to the point. Dewey said, Perry, let's review our position. Now, when you received parole, it was on condition that you never return to Kansas.
The Sunflower State. I cried my eyes out.
Feeling that way? Why did you go back? You must have had some very strong reason.
I told you. To see my sister. To get the money she was holding for me.
Oh, yes. the sister you and Hickok tried to find in Fort Scott. Perry, how far is Fort Scott from Kansas City?
Smith shook his head. He didn't know.
Well, how long did it take you to drive there?
No response.
1 hour? 2? 3? 4?
The prisoner said he couldn't remember.
Of course you can't. Because you've never in your life been to Fort Scott. Until then, neither of the detectives had challenged any part of Smith's statement.
He shifted in his chair. With the tip of his tongue, he wet his lips.
The fact is, nothing you've told us is true. You never set foot in Fort Scott. You never picked up any 2 girls and never took them to any motel.
We did. No kidding.
What were their names?
I never asked.
You and Hickok spent the night with these women and never asked their names.
They were just prostitutes.
Tell us the name of the motel.
Ask Dick. He'll know. I never remember junk like that.
Dewey addressed his colleague. Clarence, I think it's time we straightened Perry out. Dunce hunched forward. He is a heavyweight with a welterweight's spontaneous agility, but his eyes are hooded and lazy. He drawls, each word, formed reluctantly and framed in a cattle country accent, lasts a while. Yes, sir, he said. About time. Listen good, Perry, because Mr. Dunce is going to tell you where you really were that Saturday night. Where you were and what you were doing. Dunce said, you were killing the Clutter family.
Smith swallowed. He began to rub his knees.
You were out in Holcomb, Kansas, in the home of Mr. Herbert W. Clutter. And before you left that house, you killed all the people in it.
Never. I never.
Never what?
Knew anybody by that name. Clutter.
Dewey called him a liar, and then, conjuring a card that in prior consultation the 4 detectives had agreed to play face down, told him, we have a living witness, Perry. Somebody you boys overlooked. A full minute elapsed, and Dewey exulted in Smith's silence, for an innocent man would ask who was this witness, and who were these Clutters, and why did they think he'd murdered them? Would, at any rate, say something. But Smith sat quiet, squeezing his knees. Well, Perry?
You got an aspirin? They took away my aspirin.
Feeling bad?
My legs do.
It was 5:30. Dewey, intentionally abrupt, terminated the interview. We'll take this up again tomorrow, he said. By the way, do you know what tomorrow is? Nancy Clutter's birthday. She would have been 17. She would have been 17.
Perry, sleepless in the dawn hours, wondered, he later recalled, if it was true that today was the girl's birthday, and decided no, that it was just another way of getting under his skin, like that phony business about a witness, a living witness. There couldn't be. Or did they mean, if only he could talk to Dick. But he and Dick were being kept apart. Dick was locked in a cell on another floor.
Listen good, Perry, because Mr. Dunce is going to tell you where you really were. Midway in the questioning, after he'd begun to notice the number of allusions to a particular November weekend, he'd nerved himself for what he knew was coming. Yet when it did, when the big cowboy with the sleepy voice said, you were killing the Clutter family. Well, he'd damn near died, that's all.
He must have lost 10 pounds in 2 seconds.
Thank God he hadn't let them see it. Or hoped he hadn't.
And Dick?
Presumably they'd pulled the same stunt on him.
Dick was smart, a convincing performer, but his guts were unreliable. He panicked too easily. Even so, and however much they pressured him, Perry was sure Dick would hold out. Unless he wanted to hang. And before you left that house, you killed all the people in it. It wouldn't amaze him if every old grad in Kansas had heard that line. They must have questioned hundreds of men, and no doubt accused dozens. He and Dick were merely two more. On the other hand, well, would Kansas send four special agents 1,000 miles to pick up a small-time pair of parole violators? Maybe somehow they had stumbled on something, somebody, a living witness. But that was impossible. Except, he'd give an arm, a leg to talk to Dick for just 5 minutes. And Dick, awake in a cell on the floor below, was, he later recalled, equally eager to converse with Perry, find out what the punk had told them. Christ, you couldn't trust him to remember even the outline of the Funhaven alibi, though they had discussed it often enough. And when those bastards threatened him with a witness, 10 to 1 the little spook had thought they meant an eyewitness. Whereas he, Dick, had known at once who the so-called witness must be. Floyd Wells, his old friend and former cellmate. While serving the last weeks of his sentence, Dick had plotted to knife Floyd, stab him through the heart with a handmade shiv, and what a fool he was not to have done it. Except for Perry, Floyd Wells was the one human being who could link the names Hickok and Clutter. Floyd, with his sloping shoulders and inclining chin. Dick had thought he'd be too afraid. The son of a bitch was probably expecting some fancy reward. A parole, or money, or both. But hell would freeze before he got it. Because a convict's tattle wasn't proof. Proof is footprints, fingerprints, witnesses, a confession. Hell, if all those cowboys had to go on was some story Floyd Wells had told, then there wasn't a lot to worry about. Come right down to it, Floyd wasn't half as dangerous as Perry. Perry, if he lost his nerve and let fly, could put them both in the corner. And suddenly, he saw the truth. It was Perry he ought to have silenced. On a mountain road in Mexico, or while walking across the Mojave. Why had it never occurred to him until now? For now, now was much too late. Ultimately, at 3:05 that afternoon, Smith admitted the falsity of the Fort Scott tale. That was only something Dick told his family, so he could stay out overnight, do some drinking. See, Dick's dad watched him pretty close, afraid he'd break parole. So we made up an excuse about my sister. It was just to pacify Mr. Hickok. Otherwise, he repeated the same story again and again, and Dunce and Dewey, regardless of how often they corrected him and accused him of lying, could not make him change it, except to add fresh details. The names of the prostitutes, he recalled today, were Mildred and Jane, or Joan. They rolled us, he now remembered. Walked off with all our dough while we were asleep. And though even Dunce had forfeited his composure, had shed, along with tie and coat, his enigmatic, drowsy dignity, the suspect seemed content and serene. He refused to budge. He'd never heard of the Clutters or Holcomb, or even Garden City. Across the hall, in the smoke-choked room where Hickok was undergoing his second interrogation, Church and Nye were methodically applying a more roundabout strategy. Not once during this interview, now almost 3 hours old, had either of them mentioned murder, an omission that kept the prisoner edgy, expectant. They talked of everything else. Hickok's religious philosophy. I know about hell. I've been there. Maybe there's a heaven, too. Lots of rich people think so. his sexual history. I've always behaved like a 100% normal. And once more, the history of his recent cross-country hegira. Why we kept going like that, the only reason was we were looking for jobs. Couldn't find anything decent, though. I worked one day digging a ditch. But things unspoken were the center of interest. The cause, the detectives were convinced, of Hickok's escalating distress. Presently, he shut his eyes and touched the lids with trembling fingertips. And Church said, "Something wrong?" "A headache. I get real bastards." Then Nye said, "Look at me, Dick." Hickok obeyed, with an expression that the detective interpreted as a pleading with him to speak, to accuse, and let the prisoner escape into the sanctuary of steadfast denial. "When we discussed the matter yesterday, you may recall my saying that the Clutter murders were almost a perfect crime. The killers made only two mistakes. The first one was they left a witness. The second, well, I'll show you." Rising, he retrieved from a corner a box and a briefcase, both of which he'd brought into the room at the start of the interview. Out of the briefcase came a large photograph. "This," he said, leaving it on the table, "is a one-to-one reproduction of certain footprints found near Mr. Clutter's body. And here," he opened the box, "are the boots that made them. Your boots, Dick." Hickok looked and looked away. He rested his elbows on his knees and cradled his head in his hands. "Smith," said Nye, "was even more careless. We have his boots, too, and they exactly fit another set of prints. Bloody ones." Church closed in. "Here's what's going to happen to you, Hickok," he said. "You'll be taken back to Kansas. You'll be charged on 4 counts of first-degree murder. Count 1, that on or about the 15th day of November 1959, one Richard Eugene Hickok did unlawfully, feloniously, willfully, and with deliberation and premeditation, and while being engaged in the perpetration of a felony, kill and take the life of Herbert W. Clutter. Count 2, that on or about the 15th day of November 1959, the same Richard Eugene Hickok did unlawfully," Hickok said, "Perry Smith killed the Clutters." He lifted his head and slowly straightened up in the chair, like a fighter staggering to his feet. "It was Perry. I couldn't stop him. He killed them all." Postmistress Claire, enjoying a coffee break at Hartman's Cafe, complained of the low volume of the cafe's radio. "Turn it up," she demanded. The radio was tuned to Garden City's station KIUL. She heard the words, "After sobbing out his dramatic confession, Hickok emerged from the interrogation room and fainted in a hallway. KBI agents caught him as he fell to the floor." The agents quoted Hickok as saying he and Smith invaded the Clutter home expecting to find a safe containing at least $10,000. But there was no safe, so they tied the family up and shot them one by one. Smith has neither confirmed nor denied taking part in the crime. When told that Hickok had signed a confession, Smith said, "I'd like to see my buddy's statement." But the request was rejected. Officers have declined to reveal whether it was Hickok or Smith who actually shot the members of the family. They emphasized that the statement was only Hickok's version. KBI personnel, returning the two men to Kansas, have already left Las Vegas by car. It is expected the party will arrive in Garden City late Wednesday. Meanwhile, County Attorney Dwayne West... "One by one," said Mrs. Hartman. "Just imagine. I don't wonder the varmint fainted." Others in the cafe, Mrs. Clare and Mabel Helm and a husky young farmer who had stopped to buy a plug of Brown's Mule chewing tobacco, muttered and mumbled. Mrs. Helm dabbed at her eyes with a paper napkin. "I won't listen," she said. "I mustn't. I won't." News of a break in the case has met with little reaction in the town of Holcomb, a half mile from the Clutter home. Generally, townspeople in the community of 270 expressed relief. The young farmer hooted. Relief? Last night after we heard it on the TV, know what my wife did? Bawled like a baby. Shush, said Mrs. Clare. That's me. And Holcomb's postmistress, Mrs. Myrtle Clare, said the residents are glad the case has been solved, but some of them still feel others may be involved. She said plenty of folks are still keeping their doors locked and their guns ready. Mrs. Hartman laughed. Oh, Mert, she said. Who'd you tell that to? A reporter from the Telegram. The men of her acquaintance, many of them, treat Mrs. Clare as though she were another man. The farmer slapped her on the back and said, Gosh, Mert. Gee, fella, you don't still think one of us. Anybody around here had something to do with it. But that, of course, was what Mrs. Clare did think, and though she was usually alone in her opinions, this time she was not without company, for the majority of Holcomb's population, having lived for 7 weeks amid unwholesome rumors, general mistrust and suspicion, appeared to feel disappointed at being told that the murderer was not someone among themselves. Indeed, a sizable faction refused to accept the fact that two unknown men, two thieving strangers, were solely responsible. As Mrs. Clare now remarked, maybe they did it, these fellows. But there's more to it than that. Wait. Someday they'll get to the bottom, and when they do, they'll find the one behind it. The one wanted Clutter out of the way. The brains. Mrs. Hartman sighed. She hoped Mert was wrong. And Mrs. Helm said, What I hope they keep them locked up good. I won't feel easy knowing they're in our vicinity. Oh, I don't think you got to worry, ma'am, said the young farmer. Right now, those boys are a lot more scared of us than we are of them. On an Arizona highway, a two-car caravan is flashing across sagebrush country. The mesa country of hawks and rattlesnakes and towering red rocks. Dewey is driving the lead car. Perry Smith sits beside him, and Dunce is sitting in the back seat. Smith is handcuffed, and the handcuffs are attached to a security belt by a short length of chain. An arrangement so restricting his movements that he cannot smoke unaided. When he wants a cigarette, Dewey must light it for him and place it between his lips. A task that the detective finds repellent, for it seems such an intimate action. The kind of thing he'd done while he was courting his wife. On the whole, the prisoner ignores his guardians and their sporadic attempts to goad him by repeating parts of Hickok's hour-long tape-recorded confession. He says he tried to stop you, Perry, but says he couldn't. Says he was scared you'd shoot him, too. And, yes, sir, Perry. It's all your fault. Hickok himself, he says he wouldn't harm the fleas on a dog. None of this, outwardly at any rate, agitates Smith. He continues to contemplate the scenery, to read Burma-shaved doggerel, and to count the carcasses of shotgunned coyotes festooning ranch fences. Dewey, not anticipating any exceptional response, says, Hickok tells us you're a natural-born killer. Says it doesn't bother you a bit. Says one time out there in Las Vegas you went after a colored man with a bicycle chain. Whipped him to death. For fun. To Dewey's surprise, the prisoner gasps. He twists around in his seat until he can see, through the rear window, the motorcade's second car. See inside it. The tough boy. Turning back, he stares at the dark streak of desert highway. I thought it was a stunt. I didn't believe you. That Dick let fly. The tough boy. Oh, a real brass boy. Wouldn't harm the fleas on a dog. Just run over the dog. He spits. I never killed any nigger. Dunce agrees with him. Having studied the files on unsolved Las Vegas homicides, he knows Smith to be innocent of this particular deed.
I never killed any niggers.
But he thought so. I always knew if we ever got caught, if Dick ever really let fly, dropped his guts all over the goddamn floor, I knew he'd tell about the nigger. He spits again.
So Dick was afraid of me?
That's amusing.
I'm very amused.
What he don't know is, I almost did shoot him. Dewey lights two cigarettes, one for himself, one for the prisoner.
Tell us about it, Perry.
Smith smokes with closed eyes and explains.
I'm thinking. I want to remember this just the way it was.
He pauses for quite a while.
Well, it all started with a letter I got while I was out in Buell, Idaho. That was September or October. The letter was from Dick, and he said he was on to a cinch. The perfect score. I didn't answer him, but he wrote again, urging me to come back to Kansas and go partners with him. He never said what kind of score it was, just that it was a surefire cinch. Now, as it happened, I had another reason for wanting to be in Kansas around about that time. A personal matter I'd just as soon keep to myself. It's got nothing to do with this deal. Only that otherwise I wouldn't have gone back there. But I did. And Dick met me at the bus station in Kansas City. We drove out to the farm, his parents' place. But they didn't want me there. I'm very sensitive. I usually know what people are feeling. Like you. He means Dewey, but does not look at him. You hate handing me a butt. That's your business. I don't blame you. Any more than I blame Dick's mother. The fact is, she's a very sweet person. But she knew what I was. A friend from the walls. And she didn't want me in her house. Christ, I was glad to get out. Go to a hotel. Dick took me to a hotel in Olathe. We bought some beer and carried it up to the room, and that's when Dick outlined what he had in mind. He said after I'd left Lansing, he sailed with someone who'd once worked for a wealthy wheat grower out in western Kansas. Mr. Clutter. Dick drew me a diagram of the Clutter house. He knew where everything was. Doors, halls, bedrooms. He said one of the ground floor rooms was used as an office, and in the office, there was a safe. A wall safe. He said Mr. Clutter needed it because he always kept on hand large sums of cash. Never less than $10,000. The plan was to rob the safe, and if we were seen, well, whoever saw us would have to go. Dick must have said it a million times. No witnesses. Dewey says, how many of these witnesses did he think there might be? I mean, how many people did he expect to find in the Clutter house? That's what I wanted to know. But he wasn't sure. At least four. Probably six. And it was possible the family might have guests. He thought we ought to be ready to handle up to a dozen.
Dewey groans, Dunce whistles, and Smith, smiling wanly, adds,
me too.
Seemed to me that was a little off. 12 people. But Dick said it was a cinch. He said, we're going to go in there and splatter those walls with hair. The mood I was in, I let myself be carried along. But also, I'll be honest, I had faith in Dick. He struck me as being very practical, the masculine type, and I wanted the money as much as he did. I wanted to get it and go to Mexico, but I hoped we could do it without violence. Seemed to me we could if we wore masks. We argued about it. On the way out there, out to Holcomb, I wanted to stop and buy some black silk stockings to wear over our heads. But Dick felt that even with a stocking, he could still be identified. because of his bad eye. All the same, when we got to Emporia,
Dunt says, "Hold on, Perry. You're jumping ahead. Go back to Olathe. What time did you leave there?"
1:30. We left just after lunch and drove to Emporia, where we bought some rubber gloves and a roll of cord. The knife and shotgun, the shells. Dick had brought all that from home. But he didn't want to look for black stockings. It got to be quite an argument. Somewhere on the outskirts of Emporia, we passed a Catholic hospital, and I persuaded him to stop and go inside and try and buy some black stockings from the nuns. I knew nuns wear them, but he only made believe. Came out and said they wouldn't sell him any. I was sure he hadn't even asked, and he confessed it. He said it was a pukey idea. The nuns would have thought he was crazy. So we didn't stop again till Great Bend. That's where we bought the tape. Had dinner there. A big dinner. It put me to sleep. When I woke up, we were just coming into Garden City. Seemed like a real dead dog town. We stopped for gas at a filling station. Dewey asks if he remembers which one. Believe it was a Phillips 66.
What time was this?
Around midnight. Dick said it was 7 miles more to Holcomb. All the rest of the way, he kept talking to himself, saying this ought to be here and that ought to be there, according to the instructions he'd memorized. I hardly realized it when we went through Holcomb. It was such a little settlement. We crossed a railroad track. Suddenly, Dick said, "This is it. This has to be it." It was the entrance to a private road, lined with trees. We slowed down and turned off the lights. Didn't need them. Account of the moon. There wasn't nothing else up there. Not a cloud. Nothing. Just that full moon. It was like broad day. And when we started up the road, Dick said, "Look at this spread. The barns. That house. Don't tell me this guy ain't loaded." But I didn't like the setup. The atmosphere. It was sort of too impressive. We parked in the shadows of a tree. While we were sitting there, a light came on. Not in the main house, but a house maybe 100 yards to the left. Dick said it was the hired man's house. He knew because of the diagram. But he said it was a damn sight nearer the clutter house than it was supposed to be. Then the light went off. "Mr. Dewey, the witness you mentioned. Is that who you meant? The hired man?"
"No. He never heard a sound. But his wife was nursing a sick baby. He said they were up and down the whole night."
A sick baby. Well, I wondered. While we were still sitting there, it happened again. A light flashed on and off. And that really put bubbles in my blood. I told Dick to count me out. If he was determined to go ahead with it, he'd have to do it alone. He started the car. We were leaving, and I thought, bless Jesus. I've always trusted my intuitions. They've saved my life more than once. But halfway down the road, Dick stopped. He was sore as hell. I could see he was thinking, here I've set up this big score. Here we've come all this way, and now this punk wants to chicken out. He said, "Maybe you think I ain't got the guts to do it alone. But by God, I'll show you who's got guts." There was some liquor in the car. We each had a drink, and I told him, "Okay, Dick, I'm with you." So we turned back, parked where we had before. In the shadows of a tree, Dick put on gloves. I'd already put on mine. He carried the knife and a flashlight. I had the gun. The house looked tremendous in the moonlight. Looked empty. I remember hoping there was nobody home. Dewey says, But you saw a dog?
No.
The family had an old gun-shy dog. We couldn't understand why he didn't bark, unless he'd seen a gun and bolted.
Well, I didn't see anything or nobody. That's why I never believed it. About an eyewitness.
Not eyewitness. Witness. Someone whose testimony associates you and Hickok with this case.
Oh. Him. And Dick always said he'd be too scared.
Ha! Dunce, not to be diverted, reminds him, Hickok had the knife. You had the gun. How did you get into the house?
The door was unlocked. A side door. It took us into Mr. Clutter's office. Then we waited in the dark, listening. But the only sound was the wind. There was quite a little wind outside. It made the trees move, and you could hear the leaves. The one window was curtained with Venetian blinds, but moonlight was coming through. I closed the blinds, and Dick turned on his flashlight. We saw the desk. The safe was supposed to be in the wall directly behind the desk, but we couldn't find it. It was a paneled wall, and there were books and framed maps, and I noticed on a shelf a terrific pair of binoculars. I decided I was going to take them with me when we left there.
Did you? Asks Dewey, for the binoculars had not been missed.
Smith nods. We sold them in Mexico.
Sorry. Go on.
Well, when we couldn't find the safe, Dick doused the flashlight and we moved in darkness out of the office and across a parlor, a living room. Dick whispered to me, couldn't I walk quieter? But he was just as bad. Every step we took made a racket. We came to a hall and a door, and Dick, remembering the diagram, said it was a bedroom. He shined the flashlight and opened the door. A man said, "Honey?" He'd been asleep, and he blinked and said, "Is that you, honey?" Dick asked him, "Are you Mr. Clutter?" He was wide awake now. He sat up and said, "Who is it? What do you want?" Dick told him, very polite, like we were a couple of door-to-door salesmen, "We want to talk to you, sir. In your office, please." And Mr. Clutter, barefoot, just wearing pajamas, he went with us to the office and we turned on the office lights. Up till then, he hadn't been able to see us very good. I think what he saw hit him hard. Dick says, "Now, sir, all we want you to do is show us where you keep that safe." But Mr. Clutter says, "What safe?" He says he don't have any safe. I knew right then it was true. He had that kind of face. You just knew whatever he told you was pretty much the truth. But Dick shouted at him, "Don't lie to me, you son of a bitch. I know goddamn well you got a safe." My feeling was, nobody had ever spoken to Mr. Clutter like that. But he looked Dick straight in the eye and told him, being very mild about it, said, well, he was sorry, but he just didn't have any safe. Dick tapped him on the chest with the knife, says, "Show us where that safe is or you're going to be a good bit sorrier." But Mr. Clutter, oh, you could see he was scared, but his voice stayed mild and steady. He went on denying he had a safe. Sometime along in there, I fixed the telephone, the one in the office. I ripped out the wires, and I asked Mr. Clutter if there were any other telephones in the house. He said yes, there was one in the kitchen. So I took the flashlight and went to the kitchen. It was quite a distance from the office. When I found the telephone, I removed the receiver and cut the line with a pair of pliers. Then, heading back, I heard a noise, a creaking overhead. I stopped at the foot of the stairs leading to the second floor. It was dark, and I didn't dare use the flashlight.
but I could tell there was someone there. At the top of the stairs, silhouetted against a window. A figure. Then it moved away.